Happy Easter. You know, this is the third week of a message series for Easter called Without a Doubt. And over the last few weeks, Father Roger, you know, has been preaching about reconciling faith with doubt. And you might think that, you know, Peter, John, Mary Magdalene, and all the other early disciples would have had, you know, no doubt about Jesus' resurrection, you know, when they encountered the risen Christ. But the Easter stories in the Bible are actually full of doubt and doubters. And after discovering the empty tomb, you know, Mary Magdalene assumed that Jesus' body had been stolen, not raised from the dead as he promised, and she doubted. And what about last week? At this time last week, doubting Thomas refused to believe unless he saw firsthand, you know, the wounds of Christ and the nail marks in his hands and feet. And, you know, many great saints and committed followers of Christ through the ages have doubted at some point in their lives, you know, including, you know, people like, you know, Mother Teresa herself. And so the premise of this series is that faith and doubt are not enemies. And doubt is natural. Doubt can even be good when it ultimately pushes us, you know, to a deeper level of belief. But although doubt is a part of our human condition, you know, we ultimately have to make a choice. And not choosing is a choice. What we choose to believe and the way we live our lives amounts to, you know, a spiritual wager. And if we choose God and it turns out in the end that God does not exist, we lost nothing except a life of love and goodness. If we refuse to believe in God and it turns out in the end that we are wrong, we've lost everything. So, and there, you know, are many rational reasons, you know, to believe in God. Philosophical arguments for the existence of a higher power and recent, you know, scientific discoveries about the universe that point toward an intelligent creator. But the real rub, the deeper leap to make is from believing to trusting, from acknowledgement to devotion, from intellectual assent to worship and love of God. And that takes a community where, you know, faith is shared and celebrated together. No matter where you are right now in your faith, we are all here together to strengthen each other. You know, this week's gospel passage also is a story about doubt. Two of Jesus' disciples were walking together along a road out of Jerusalem. The story takes place on the first day of the week, which would be the Sunday after Jesus' crucifixion. And they were going to a village 7 miles from Jerusalem called Emmaus. And as they were, you know, talking about everything that had happened to Jesus, a stranger comes along that starts walking with them. And it is Jesus, but they don't recognize him. And he asks what they are talking about. And they stopped, as you remember in the gospel, they stopped looking downcast. One of them, named Cleopas, said to him in reply, "Are you the only visitor to Jerusalem who does not know of the things that have taken place there in these days?" Notice how Cleopas assumes Jesus was a visitor to Jerusalem and not a resident. He was walking along the same road away from the city, so, you know, he naturally thought this stranger was doing the same thing that they were doing, running away. Although scholars still debate exactly where Emmaus was, we do know there was a warm well there because that's what the name means. So Emmaus was a kind of resort town somewhere out on the outskirts of Jerusalem. It would have been a safe place to escape, you know, the hostility of the crucifixion. These two disciples, you know, were upset. You know, they were confused, discouraged, and disillusioned. And their teacher, you know, the one they had followed had been condemned to death, suffered the cruelest form of execution known to man. The whole Jesus movement, you know, seemed to have imploded, you know, as a miserable failure. And Cleopas and the other disciples were getting out of Dodge, you know, attempting to flee from the sadness and disappointment. And, you know, when Jesus pushes for more details and asks what sort of things they were talking about, what does Cleopas say? He says, this thing that happened to Jesus, the Nazarene, who was a prophet mighty in deed and word, you know, before God and all the people, how our chief priests and rulers both handed him over to a sentence of death and crucified him. But we were hoping that he would be the one to redeem Israel. And beside all this, it is now the third day since this took place. Now, some women from our group, however, have astounded us. They were at the tomb early in the morning and did not find his body. They came back and reported that they had seen a vision of angels who announced that he was alive. Then some of those with us went to the tomb and found things just as the women had described, but him they did not see. So it is one of the strongest statements of doubt in the Gospels. You know, they had hoped Jesus would redeem Israel, but now they have no hope. It was the third day since his death, so now obviously, you know, it was too late for a miracle. The women had found the empty tomb, but not Jesus. So evidently, there were no angels. There was no vision. The women were wrong. Jesus was not alive. It was all over. And they were getting out of town and leaving the misery behind them. And they were filled with doubt. And so Jesus responds, oh, how foolish you are. How slow to heart to believe all that the prophets spoke. You know, but can you really blame them after having witnessed the unimaginable suffering, the senseless violence, the frightening, you know, mob scene, and the brutal death Jesus endured? I mean, of all the reasons faith surrenders to doubt, and gives in to disbelief, the most common and most disturbing is the question of human suffering, You know, we live in a broken world where innocent children get sick and die, bad things happen to good people, and the poor and the vulnerable, you know, bear the brunt of human selfishness and greed. And, you know, why does God allow it all? Why does God allow war, genocide, ethnic cleansing? Why does God allow natural disasters, painful diseases, school shootings, and you know, thousands of other kinds of tragedies, you know, that devastate communities and bring people to their knees? You know, Father Roger and I attended seminary together, and we were ordained, you know, in the same year. Now I'm his boss. But truth be told, he's the one who got me through the tough academic coursework. I would never have made it through without him, his legalistic mind, his trap. He remembered everything. We'd have a conversation at dinner time, and 15 minutes into it, he said, yeah, but you said this. And I said, oh, you're right. And I think, gee, I'd like to be able to learn how to do that. Anyway, I'm here. I have to pick up the slack while he's gallivanting in Switzerland, which is fine. You know, But anyway, before I became a priest, I was a licensed funeral director. I was in the business since I was 13, not licensed then, but for many years. And I have seen my share of human tragedy and heartbreak, accidents of all kinds, suicides, murders, debilitating illnesses that took people much too early, and worst of all, the death of children. It's enough to shake one's faith. But I remember once standing inside my funeral home, there was a large room, maybe the size of your, not the master bedroom in your home, but say just a bedroom in your home. And that was the size of my refrigeration, where that's where we kept the dead. And until their funeral. And on a particular day, I walked in there and all the shelves were filled. Large room, not just along the walls. I had to go in, roll in shelves also. It was completely full. And I stood there looking at the evidence of a God whom many people believe doesn't care. And I thought, there has to be more than this. And that's the day I decided to become a priest. In the midst of tears and unimaginable suffering, it's natural to doubt. And we shake our fists at God. We walk away, from the carnage in disgust and to conclude that God is dead, just like those bodies in our refrigeration there at the funeral home. And suffering robs us of our joy. Suffering strips us of the one thing that makes us human, and that's hope. And every philosophy and world religion has had to deal with this question of suffering. Hinduism blames it on karma, the belief that tragedy is a byproduct, of our own failures, either in this life or in a past life. Buddhism denies that suffering exists at all. It's just a state of mind, an illusion, born of human desire. Give up those desires and you won't hurt. In Islam, suffering is a result of unbelief and human wickedness. And atheists simply claim that suffering exists because there is no God and the universe ultimately is meaningless. But you know what? The Bible describes a God who comes near to us in our pain. Very interesting. Describes a God who comes near to us in our pain. A God who cares. A God who suffers with us. And we do not have a God who explains suffering, but rather entered into the brokenness of this world. For most people, the crucifixion, brings up a range of emotions. Horror, sadness, disgust, confusion, outrage, guilt, anger, but the longer I journey in this life as a Christian, the more I have come to realize that the greatest emotion I feel, when I see the cross of Jesus Christ, is relief. Relief that I am not alone in my suffering. Relief that I believe in a God who is not indifferent to the human condition. Relief that God cares so much for us that he would endure everything, experience every hardship, and feel all the grief and all the despair we do, so that we would not, we would know that we are not alone in our suffering. Jesus was betrayed and abandoned, so we who have been deceived and forgotten by others can find comfort in Jesus. He was harmed, so we who have been hurt or will know we have a friend in Jesus. He was treated inhumanely, so we could feel human even in the most degrading conditions. And he was mocked to console us when we are ridiculed and judged. His body failed on the cross to bring us hope when our bodies one day fail. And he died surrendering his soul to God to strengthen us as we experience the fear of passing from this world to the next. The two disciples on the road to Emmaus begged the stranger to stay with them because night was coming. So he went in to stay with them, and it happened that while he was with them at table, he took bread, said the blessing, broke it, and gave it to them. And with that, brothers and sisters, their eyes were open and they recognized him. Then Jesus vanished. He couldn't stay because why? The work now was theirs to do. It was now their turn. So they set out at once and returned to Jerusalem. They had the courage to go back to the place that held so much grief for them and do the work of spreading the hope of the gospel to a suffering and broken world. And it is the same for us today. You know, Christ is in our midst today to break open the scriptures and to break bread in our company. You know, the reason why I ran towards my faith the day I walked into the mortuary refrigeration and saw all these bodies and not run away from it, the reason I chose to be a priest that day rather than retreat in doubt and disbelief, it is because of this truth that Christ has entered into the shrapnel of our ruined world and suffers with us. Doesn't watch us suffer, he suffers with us. And that one fact alone gives me hope. Now the author, J.R.R. Tolkien once said this. He said, the birth and death and resurrection of Jesus means that one day everything sad will come untrue. Somehow in the mystery of eternity and the mercy of God, every tragedy be undone one day because Christ one day entered into our suffering. You know, a pastor named Bruce Thielemann put it this way. He says, imagine a colony of grubs living on the bottom of a swamp. And every once in a while, one of these grubs is inclined to climb a leaf stem to the surface. And then he disappears above the surface and never returns. And all the grubs wondered, you know, why this is so and what it must be like up there. So they gathered, they counseled among themselves and agreed that that the next one who goes up will come back and tell the others. So they all agreed. Not long after that, you know, one of the grubs, you know, feels the urge to climb that leaf stem and goes out above the surface onto a lily pad. And the warmth, and there in the warmth of the sun, he falls asleep. While he's asleep, the carapace of the tiny creature breaks open, and out of the inside of the grub comes a magnificent dragonfly with beautiful, wide, rainbow-hued, iridescent wings. And he spreads those wings and flies, soaring out over the waters. But then he remembers the commitment he had made to those behind. Yet now he knows he cannot return. They would not recognize him in the first place, and beyond that, he could not live again in such a place. I mean, I've never seen a dragonfly fly underwater. But one thought of his takes of this takes away all the distress. You know, they too shall climb the stem, and they too will come and shall know the glory.